Donc, on va recommencer avec M. Georges Flores, qui est professeur à l'Institut universitaire européen de Florence. M. Flores, que je connais depuis très longtemps, il faut dire, a beaucoup publié notamment sur les Portugais dans l'océan Indien. Il avait commencé avec des travaux portant sur le Ceylan, sur le Sri Lanka. Il a aussi travaillé sur les Portugais en Extrême-Orient et en Afrique de l'Est. Mais aujourd'hui, il va parler de l'Inde et sur un endroit qui a déjà été évoqué quelques fois hier, c'est-à-dire Surat. Donc, c'est de Surat à Hooghly dans les années 1630, sur les conflits donc, entre les Moghols et les Portugais autour du commerce et de la religion. Voilà.
Well, good morning. Sanjay, thank you very much for the invitation. Muito obrigado pelo convite. There's this widespread idea among, I think, academic scholarly circles in Paris that all the Portuguese scholars who come here speak very good French, and I'm the exception. So I'm afraid I'll go against the stereotype and I'll have to present it in English, but I'll be more than happy to answer questions that are going to be posed in French, so no problem at all. What I'd like to do today is to look at the ways in which, or possible ways in which, the Portuguese and the Mughals entered in contact in the 17th century, a mixture of violence, cooperation, tension, pragmatism, ideology, and I think these two cases, and especially the second one, I'm going especially to focus myself on the second one, show this kind of complexity of the relationship between the two. And the relationship between the two actually were not obvious, in the sense that if you want to engage in an exercise of counterfactual history, if Babur decided after coming to Delhi to withdraw, and if Humayun died in Persia and wouldn't come back as Mughal emperor, or even most probably, or more importantly, if Akbar didn't think about the maritime, what the sultanates that would become the maritime provinces of the empire, most probably they would never met, because the Portuguese were in Goa, were considered themselves as a maritime empire, although with some inland ventures even in the Indian Ocean or in maritime in Asia, and of course in Brazil most obviously. There is a big probability that they would not actually encounter or clash. Because the Portuguese were thinking about other stuff, and then the Mughals, until they thought about Bengal and Gujarat and then the Deccan, were a bit far from the Portuguese sphere. Of course, there are contacts and there are sort of mutual connections between the period of Babur and the period of Humayun, the part of the 16th century, but things become really more clear when Akbar takes the two maritime provinces, Gujarat and Bengal, in the 1570s, where the Portuguese had interests since the early 16th century, and then in the 1590s, Orissa and Sindh, which were conquered in that period, and also the Portuguese had some interests in those two areas. So if you look at the Gujarat and Bengal, there's a long tradition throughout the 16th and the 17th century of clashes, of moments of very strong tension between the two. And I think these two conflicts, 1630 in Surat and especially Hooghly in 1632, are a good example of that. But as a sort of tradition of prehistory of these two conflicts that one has to consider. And in those conflicts, trade, religion, and politics are really enmeshed. It's difficult to disentangle these three components. And the case of Hooghly is a good example of that. So, of course, what we intend to contradict here is something which is now already solved in a way, which is this artificial dichotomy between a continental empire, which doesn't care about the maritime world, sort of continental agrarian political entities like the Mughals, like the Chinese, who don't care about the maritime horizon, and on the other hand, a sort of rigid maritime Portuguese empire with no clue about what was going on in continental areas like mainland India. So there's something in between the two, and I think these cases that I bring today show that reality. And of course, this leads us to the strong connection between the Mughal emperors and the Mughal imperial elite and maritime activities. And we know of this for a long period now. You know, remember this article published by Satish Chandra in 1959 in Bengal Past and Present, where he speaks about the ways in which the Mughal emperors were engaged in commercial affairs, maritime commercial affairs, owning vessels, dealing with merchants and moneylenders, of course, eager to have taxes from the ports. And there's this strong connection to the sea, which you see emperor after emperor, up to Aurangzeb, and it's very clear also in the period of Shah Jahan, which is the period I've chosen here today. And actually, it's, I think, interesting to look at that reality by focusing on some European anecdotes about this kind of reality. And I bring some Portuguese and some Dutch examples, and the Dutch were kindly translated to me by a friend of mine, which show this kind of in a way that sometimes the Portuguese were puzzled, or the Dutch were puzzled, with this kind of very strong commitment towards maritime trade. Actually, we can also relate this to the overall perception of Shah Jahan among the different Europeans, the Dutch, the Portuguese, and the English. If you focus on the Portuguese Jesuit perception, it's usually a very negative perception. It's more complicated than that. I will come to that later. But usually it's very, very negative, because there's a sort of golden period before with the Jesuit missions with Akbar and Jahangir. Corinne yesterday spoke a bit about Jahangir and his religious policy. We know less about Shah Jahan's religious policy, less about Aurangzeb's religious policy. Also an article by Satish Chandra on that. But we know more about Akbar, of course, and Jahangir is becoming more and more interesting for a number of people, and many of them in this room. So the classical Portuguese idea and Jesuit idea about Shah Jahan is very negative, by contrast with the two predecessors. You know, they had hopes about Akbar, they had hopes about Jahangir. When it comes to Shah Jahan, he's the Orthodox Muslim, and they think... Of course, they don't think of converting him. They don't think of interacting in him the ways in which they interacted with Akbar and Jahangir. And the wording becomes really very harsh. There's a letter, actually more than one, by this Florentine Jesuit called Francesco Corsi, who calls Shah Jahan, who ruled between 1628 and 1658, he calls him... Moorish dog, cão mouro. He says this twice. So it's really strong when compared with the kind... Even when the Jesuits are disappointed with Akbar and Jahangir, they don't come to this kind of wording. It's really clear the difference between the two. And also, if you look at state documents, the kind of documents were produced in Goa, there's also... There are mixed feelings, but there's a sort of arch judgment about Shah Jahan. And they are much less lenient about Shah Jahan when compared with the kind of attitude and perception they had of the two predecessors. So it's interesting to, in a way, to deconstruct a bit of this, because it's more complicated than that. And on the other hand, to relate that to the kind of commercial activities that Shah Jahan was engaged in, leading him to this kind of conflicts with Surat, with the Portuguese in Surat, and especially in Ugli in the early 1630s. So there are interesting examples like, I'll show you. So we have Shah Jahan here, and then this other interesting Sadullah Khan was Vazir in the Shah Jahan's period. And one of the Dutch observers says at some point that he was puzzled that Shah Jahan, who usually presented himself in a sort of very majestic way, at some point was asking the Dutch a sort of trading pass for his own vassals. So he was puzzled with the fact that a big king like Shah Jahan, usually very much engaged in political ritual, in apparatus, in symbolic ways of displaying his power and his authority, would beg the Dutch a simple trading pass. And actually, you see here some Europeans when Sadullah Khan is giving audience. So. It's an interesting example of these contracts between someone who presents himself as very powerful, and then the connections to the trading world and the ways in which the Europeans perceived that kind of reality. Then we have Princess Jayanara. Sanjay yesterday spoke about her a bit. Also very much engaged in trading activities, and also referred to, especially in these Dutch sources that I had access to, and one of them said, in a way, the Dutch were received by her as if they were received by Shahjahan. A lot of political ritual. They were really impressed by the ways in which the Jayanara received them, and they were puzzled with the fact that at some point she asked them to bring from Surat Spanish wine, because she wanted Spanish wine. So they had to buy to the English in Surat Spanish wine, so that she was more happy with them, and eventually grant them some more commercial favors and so forth. So it's another interesting anecdote regarding this connection between the courtly world and the world of trade in this period. Then, if we move to Asaf Khan, the father-in-law of Shahjahan, there's extensive dealings with the Portuguese. They are more or less well documented from the Portuguese side of it. And you see this complexity, because he writes letters to Shahjahan, to the Portuguese viceroy. There are at least two Portuguese versions, Portuguese translations of his letters. And we see the ways in which the Portuguese, both the Portuguese and Goa and the Jesuits, were trying to connect with him, trying to engage with him. And again, it's a very complex game between a number of things. They knew that he had authority. They was, of course, close to Shahjahan. He could influence Shahjahan. And on the other hand, he was very interested in having these trading activities from the Red Sea to Aceh. So, and whenever he had problems, he would ask the Jesuits to ask the viceroy to solve the problems, because he wanted his vessels, to circulate freely from the Red Sea to the Aceh without no problems. The ways in which the Portuguese were controlling the sea, or theoretically controlling the sea, and granting safe conducts for people to circulate or not to circulate. This is called the so-called cartazes. So there's interesting literature on especially a group of documents from the Jahangir period, 1610s, on different Mughal officials coming to Goa to ask for safe conducts, and all the negotiations about safe conducts, and the Portuguese granting some, denying others. And you see the actors which were involved in this game. It's a very interesting set of documents. And one of them actually relates to Shahjahan still as prince in 1618, as Prince Khurram. And that document is interesting, because it's in 1618, Prince Khurram writes a letter to the Portuguese viceroy. He wants more safe conducts for his own ships. He's Subadar of Gujarat by then, and he wants the Portuguese to grant him more safe conducts. And the Portuguese deny that. And actually, they react to the tone of the letter. This is very harsh. It's not very rude letter. He doesn't say, but almost they say, behaves like a king. He behaves in a very authoritative way. And in a way, it's the beginning of the perception of a sort of negative perception of Shahjahan in 1618, when he's still prince and still Subadar of Gujarat. So, if you look at Surat, and yesterday Sanjay spoke specifically about Surat, the Portuguese were very much involved in the region. They had a fortress in Diu. They wanted to control navigation in the region. So many of the conflicts took place in Surat between the Mughals and the Portuguese. Again, there's a sort of prehistory of them until 1630, but in 1630 there's a crucial one, which has to do with the Portuguese capture of two vessels, one of them belonging to Shahjahan, off Surat. They were off Surat. And this happened in March 1630, and there's a long process of tension and negotiation that goes from March to November of 1630, which is very well documented from the Portuguese side. There are references in previous conflicts. There are references, for example, Jahangir Nama, Jahangir speaks about a similar conflict in the 1610s. So there are possibilities of contrasting sources from both sides. And so what you have in this conflict of 1630, I won't elaborate much on this one to have more time for the ugly one. But what we have there is, first of all, a strong political actor, a strong mediator, strong character who represents Shah Jahan. His name is Mir Musa. He's Mutasadi of Surat. So he's the governor of Surat. And he's the one who has to act in favor on behalf of Shah Jahan. So he has extensive connections to the Portuguese during this period. And he writes letters to the viceroy. The viceroy in this period is this man, the Count of Linhares. He rules in Goa from 1629 to 1635. And you have an early 17th century plan of Goa with the, where is this? It's here actually, is his palace. So this is the man who had ruling during 6 years, in the early years of his reign, his viceroyalship, 1630 to 1632. He had to deal with these two problems. And the interesting thing is that from the Portuguese side, you have a number of very different sources. You have the official chronicles for the period. You have religious documents, especially very strong for the Ugly conflict in 1632. You also have Jesuit mediators in 1630 in Surat. And then you have a number of state documents, which are very interesting. For example, the viceroy writes a diary. You only have two diaries written by viceroys, and this actually is the most extensive one. It's not complete. It covers more or less 3 years out of six. But it's very interesting because he daily writes about what happens. He also writes a bit about himself. And actually includes in the diary some documents. For example, the letter from Asaf Khan to Linhares, to the Count of Linhares, to the viceroy, is included in the diary, the Portuguese translation, I mean. And on top of that, or related to that, you have the so-called proceedings of the Council of State. There was a Council of State in Goa who regularly met to discuss this kind of issues, and you have the proceedings of that, which were published in the 1950s in Goa by Pissur Lenkar, so this is available in print. And it's especially for the case of Ugly, it's important to consider this kind of diversity of the Portuguese sources, which actually give you the diversity, convey in a way the diversity of the positions themselves. You have very different positions in what we call the Portuguese side, and I will come to that. So by going through this Portuguese perception of the conflicts from Goa and, of course, also from Diu, you have, I think, a very interesting picture of what the governors of Surat were. And you see the Portuguese had extensive dealings with Mir Musa, the guy who was negotiating with the Portuguese the two vessels which were captured in 1630. But also in sort of very interesting and almost equal precedent in the 1630s with someone called Mukarrab Khan. There are two articles on Mukarrab Khan in English. I also wrote a bit about him and about Mir Musa. And the picture is a very interesting one in the sense that you see that these people were very well, they had their own agenda. They were, of course, close to the emperor and were part of the Mughal imperial elite. They wanted to be part of that and to play according to the rules of it. But they were also very at ease with the trading world, the Europeans in Gujarat, and the differences between Dutch, the English, and the Portuguese. And you get the impression that they were playing with all of them. And actually, I did this exercise with English sources and with the Portuguese sources, and the Portuguese blame them because they are more close to the English and the other way around. So you have the English complaining, no, this man works for the Portuguese for sure. So it's clear that they have an agenda, and they can navigate this very difficult lines between the different Europeans, the emperor, the continental aspect, the ritual political aspect, and the trading world of the ports. They were, of course, in charge of finding exotic commodities for the emperor, And you get the feeling of that through the Portuguese sources. For example, this Mukarrab Khan came to Goa in the 1610s as ambassador of Jahangir to Goa. And you have an extensive report about what he did in Goa. He wrote, he bought a lot of stuff for the emperor. He was negotiating the prices. And at some point, there was, this is actually a religious, part of a religious chronicle. And at some point, through the Jesuits' voices, apparently he said, I would like to convert. So there's something which is a trope, an heathen conversion. He wants to convert, but he doesn't want the other people who came with him from the capital to know about that. So it becomes an heathen conversion. And an heathen conversion at closed door with no one seeing. Suddenly has a new name. He's called Don Juan de Távora, because the viceroy by then was a guy called Távora. And so the Portuguese have a lot of hope on this man. He has converted as an ambassador of the Mughals to Goa. And then, of course, he becomes a different thing. They don't understand. They call him traitor. And it becomes a sort of black legend of Mukarrab Khan throughout the 1610s. But to give you an example of how he was playing with a number of factors, and was, of course, curious about Goa, about religion, about trade, engaging with a number of people. The chronicle says that at some point he rode an elephant together with one of the Jesuits to see one of his vessels being launched to the sea. So you see these connections with the sea, with trade, but also religion being present in this context. So 1610s with Mukarrab Khan, and then Mir Musa in the 1630s is a sort of replica of that. Of that kind of behavior and of that kind of profile. Again, we have a number of letters that he wrote to the Portuguese viceroy. And the Portuguese viceroy has an idea of him truly as a merchant. At some point he writes, he's a mercador mais do que cavaleiro. So he's more a merchant than a noble. And he says, you know, he's invested commercially on this. So we will come to something in terms of a negotiation. And actually there was a negotiation and things went well in the 1630s between the Portuguese and the Mughals. There was no direct confrontation and things stopped in November 1630 with negotiations, many of them conducted by other people, but also by Jesuit missionaries. To give you a last example about Surat, another governor of Surat in the 1640s after this conflict, a guy called Mir Ali Akbar, who writes a letter to the Portuguese viceroy asking to grant him the possibility of sending a vessel of him from Surat to China. And this is, actually this was discussed in the Council of Revenue in Goa, and they have decided to grant him that favor. And we know that the wording is very interesting because from the Portuguese side, they consider Mir Ali Akbar as vassal of the Portuguese king. And they at some point said he's a friend of the Estado, a friend of the state of India. So there is no religion, no ideological confrontation in this context. And there's a simple negotiation of the terms of this kind of long voyage between Surat and China. He says, I pay all the taxes in all the ports that you control, and most probably it would be good if you decide to bring a banya as representative of the Estado. So it becomes more complex. All these articulations become clearly more complex in the case of Mir Ali Akbar in the 1640s. So when we move to the other side of, now to the Bay of Bengal, in 1632, the situation, it's a bit more confrontational. There is, as many of you know, a long involvement of the Portuguese in the western side of, well, in Bengal, in the Ganges Delta, but in the western side of it. You see the port of Satgon, where the Portuguese were at a very early period. They call it the little port of Bengal, Port Pequeno de Bengala. There's a number of sources on that since the early 16th century. A number of people worked on that, including Sanjay. And at some point in the 1580s, Ugli becomes more important than Satgon. And when we come to the conflict in the 1630s, Ugli has a life of 50 years, more or less, as an important port in the region, with the Portuguese being very much involved in the port. And at some point in 1632, there is this Mughal attack to Ugli. The colony is destroyed, and the Portuguese and the Christians are either killed or they go as captives to Agra in the same period. And this is a big event, and I would actually try to look at the event itself, but then also at sort of the day after and the afterlife of the event from different perspectives, which actually give you an idea of the complexity of what is at stake here. So the siege lasted for 3 months, between late June 1632 and late September or early October 1632. From the Mughal side, the official side of the official perspective of the Mughals regarding this event, it's very clear that it was also a sort of ideological confrontation against the Portuguese. If you go through the chronicles, the ones I know in English translation, you see the wording is very strong. To fight contamination, the Portuguese brought contamination to this place. They have infected the population with the Christian faith. So it's different from Surat, because in Surat in 1630, you don't have this kind of wording. It's a commercial problem. What we have in Surat in 1630 is that, you know, okay, you the Portuguese say that you control the sea, but these two vessels were off Surat. This is Surat. This is not the open Indian Ocean. So there was a sort of juridical discussion of the ways in which the Portuguese wanted to control the sea, but not really a religious discussion. And Mir Musa, the discussions between Mir Musa and the Viceroy Count of Linhares from the Portuguese perspective never come into a religious ideological debate. But here you have this kind of wording from the Mughal side, which actually is very interesting to compare with something sort of similar situation in Macau, more or less in the same period throughout the 17th century. Sanjay, in the first day, said that we would stop and not venture into the China Sea, but I like to make this comparison because I think there are interesting parallels to explore. On the one hand, Ugli, it's what the Portuguese, within the framework of the Portuguese Estado da Índia, called a bandel, from the Persian word bandar, right? So, which has a double meaning in the Portuguese context. It can be port as bandar, or it can be a Portuguese colonial settlement within a port. Right? So they keep, when you go through Portuguese documents, you find this word many of them. The bandeis that the Portuguese have in different places in Bengal and in other places. And actually, there are a number of them, a number of smaller communities in Bengal. Ugli is perhaps the most prominent one. But then you have places like Ayutthaya, for example, in Thailand. It's also a bandel, very active in the late 17th century, in the period of King Narai and the aftermath in the late 17th century. You have good sources also to study that. So what I would argue is that first we need a sort of coherent, comprehensive history of the Portuguese bandeis that's still to be done. And secondly, that there are a number of parallels between a case like Ugli and a case like Macau. And I would argue that Macau, which was Chinese territory administered by the Portuguese until 1999, started as a bandel. And then it developed to something more official, more consolidated, more institutional, and became at some point under the radar of the Portuguese official structure in Goa and in Lisbon, but it started as such. It has a number of features that really put Macau in dialogue and in contact with many other cases, and Ugli is a good case. So if you go through the kind of exercise that some Chinese scholars did regarding Chinese perceptions of Macau since the early 16th century, like Kisi Thok, for example. He has this dissertation and a number of articles on Chinese sources on Macau. And you see the same kind of wording. There's no religion there. There's no idea of, you infected the population with Christian faith. But there's this idea of turmoil, of systematic turmoil that the Portuguese brought to the region, which is under Chinese authority, as it was here under Mughal authority, and suddenly there's a sort of systematic unrest in the region that the Portuguese brought. So it's the same kind of situation when you compare the two. For example, in Macau, they have sentences like this: Macau is a ulcer that is there's almost it is going to birth at some point. So they were and they were the Chinese were clearly trying to avoid that the Portuguese had fortresses that were sort of very stable settlement. They were against the idea of a stable settlement of the Portuguese in the region, which in a way I think it's also a reason why Sha Jiang, we don't really know the reasons why Sha Jiang decided to attack and to eliminate Ugli and the Portuguese colony of Ugli. There's a lot of speculation on that. You can read it through a number of sources. But my view is that there is some concern with this idea of social unrest in the region that belongs to the empire. And again, the parallel with China is a good one. So, in the official discourse of the Mughals, this became, I think, a big thing because it has a visual expression. I don't know if many of you know these two miniatures. This is in Pachanama. In Windsor Castle was published by Eberhock and Milo Beach in 1999, if I'm not mistaken. And so in the Pachanama, there are two miniatures representing the Ugli problem. The first one, actually, in the manuscript, this is the second one, but chronologically, this is the first one, is the attack itself. And you see the explosions, you see a Catholic church there, you see the Portuguese running, and this is, I think, a telling example of what happened from a Mughal perspective, and it's important that it was included in a manuscript like this one. So this is one aspect that I would like to emphasize. The second one is the entry of the captives in Agra and the audience by Sha Jiang. And this was actually studied by Eberhock, and she shows clearly that they are in a marginal, spatially speaking, they are in a marginal part of the scene. They are well dressed because they are not supposed to present themselves in front of the emperor in sort of obelisk people, but they are captives and they are presented there bringing offers. It looks like a nice scene, but it's not really the best scene for the Portuguese side. So these two are included in the Pachanama. Then he writes a letter to the Safavid ruler in 1633 where he speaks about this. Apart from the chronicles that we know, he speaks about this in a letter to the Safavid ruler, and he couples this event with the end of the rebellion by Khan Jahan Lodi, in the same period, more or less the same period, and his attacks to the Western Deccan Sultanate. So he sees this event in close connection to the end of an Afghan rebellion, and which actually was putting in danger his own authority, and also his idea of controlling the Deccan Sultanate in the south. So it becomes part of the official rhetoric of the emperor of Sha Jiang in this period. But then this contrasts heavily with what happened soon after, because in 1633, the Portuguese are back to the region. And so you have this very strong ideological discourse, but then on the other hand, you have the return of the Portuguese. And suddenly you have again the Portuguese coming to Ugli, to other small colonies in the region, and a number of sources actually expressing that kind stating that kind of phenomenon. There's this testimony by an English called Thomas Coley in Orissa, 1633. He says, "Those Portingals expelled from Ugli have found great favor with Sha Jiang and re-enter the place to the number of 20 persons. So that our expectation of Ugli is frustrated, and I fear likewise, Pipli will not by us be obtained." So this is 1633. The event was in 1632, and suddenly there is this change between a very, you know, the harsh wording of infecting the population and so forth, and presenting the scene in the Pachamama, and on the other hand, the return, which was authorized by Shah Jahan the following year. So there's a sort of contradiction in terms between the two, or some tension between ideological discourse and economic pragmatism. We don't know, but that's really what happened. From the Portuguese side, we know of this all through a number of sources. And an interesting one, which is the copy of the Portuguese translation of a Farman of 1633, actually regulating this return. It's a tricky document in the sense that we only know it first through a Portuguese translation, secondly through a 19th century copy. So it's not the 17th century copy. So it's more tricky. We don't know if the original document was really according to the terms of the Portuguese translation and copy of the 19th century. But it's an interesting document because it says the Portuguese will have freedom of religion. And it's a document which is totally different from this kind of wording and this kind of images that we have in 1632. So from the Portuguese side, we have a number of possible reactions. We have a strong political reaction, or the idea of a strong political reaction, by Linhares when he says, "Well, you know, I have to fight them back, so I will try to destroy Surat." And this is stated in many documents. One possibility was to try to destroy Surat, and then he withdraws and he forgets the idea. Also, the idea they have played and they have toyed with the idea with an alliance with Arakan in Lower Burma to fight the Mughals in Bengal. And finally, there's this very interesting text in 1637 by a guy called Tomé Vaz Garrido. This is known, but actually the text itself was not very well studied yet, which is, in technical terms, for the ones who are more schooled on the history of Portugal and Spain, is an arbitrio. So the arbitrio is these people who write, the arbitristas, these people who write, you know, advices for the king to solve particular problems, financial problems of the state, problems of the empire itself. And you have very different arbitrios. People usually focused on the most European ones, so to say, the ones which related to the ways in which the Philips were supposed to rule from Madrid, and the technical, the financial aspects of the empire itself. But there are others which are more ethnographical. These are the ones that I'm most interested in. And this, by Tomé Vaz Garrido, is a good example of them. It was not published. So what he says is that he writes to the Portuguese king, say, you know, I know a lot about this region. This is 1637. I know a lot about this region. I have a lot of experience in the region. And what I suggest is that we conquer Bengal. And this actually is very much in line with the tradition of utopian projects of conquest that the Portuguese put forward since the late second half, the late 16th century, many of them actually towards China, for example. Again, we have a sort of comparison. And some of the arguments of Garrido regarding Bengal are actually comparable to some of the arguments that you find on these very interesting projects to conquer China. So he says a number of things, but one of the things he says is that, you know, he senses that Mughal authority in Bengal is not stable. And so one of the things he says is that we can try to explore this medium level. So you have the governor in Dhaka, but you have these regional lords, the buyas, the Portuguese call them boiões, and they are very much into the Portuguese. So if we are 12, if I'm not mistaken, if we have an alliance with them, this will be ours. And so what we can do actually is to build three fortresses. One would be in Dhaka, and we would have, this actually would be bigger than the state of India, so this is sort of new state of India, and you can have it doesn't say a viceroy, but it says you can have a governor, a Christian governor in Dhaka, replacing the Mughal governor, and if we bring 300 to 400 Christians, they will disseminate Christianity, and this will become a Christian empire. So again, this is impossible, as we know. It's very close again to the Chinese, to the conquest Chinese, to the arguments put forth by people who thought about conquering China from Canton. They say these people are weak from a military point of view. There are internal divisions among them, so we can explore them. And from Canton, we move north. The project itself is interesting. There's a lot of religion in it because he senses and he wants to think and to sell the idea that this can be bigger than the state of India and it can be a Christian empire where the Mughals and the Muslims would be replaced in a way. Of course, this was discussed, but was abandoned. It's an idea that didn't fly. And the Portuguese were much more invested in a very low-profile return, which actually couples well with the kind of sources and the kind of reactions we have from the Mughals and from the English testimony that I have quoted. They sent a Portuguese man schooled in the region called Gaspar Pacheco de Mesquita as a merchant to speak with all the subadars in the region, all the governors, and to assure that the Portuguese would return in a very informal, calm way. And that's what Gaspar and Pacheco de Mesquita did. We know of the letters he wrote from Bengal. We know of the meetings he had with regional authorities. And you see a sort of no religion, no confrontation. Actually, the wording of Linhares is an interesting one because he behaves as someone who is very schooled on Baroque governance. He speaks of dissimulation. I would like to do this, but I cannot, so I will dissimulate. There's a lot of dissimulation in it, which is strong in 17th century Europe. And you see clearly the difference between sorts of hardline reaction, which actually the Portuguese wouldn't get there, and a more smooth, pragmatic approach to the problem. And this contrasts heavily with the religious sources and some of the religious sources that we have for this event. If you go through, and very briefly because I'm running out of time, if you go through the Augustinian chronicles, because there are Augustinian missionaries in the region, they are again very ideological, in very sharp contrast with what was decided and discussed in Goa in the State Council, for example. So they compare the long march between Ugli and Agra to the Babylonian captivity, martyrdom and captivity, which are strong elements of the Portuguese Empire, especially after 1578, King Sebastian Morocco, are very much present in Augustinian texts. And they give interesting examples of miracles. I will briefly mention two. This guy called Frei João da Cruz, which was miraculously saved by an unknown woman who cured him from a wound on his back. And once he recovered, he walked together with the other survivors all the way to Agra. There's a small article by Henry Austin saying, very empirical one, he was trying to trace this Frei João da Cruz. I said, no, this man died in Ugli for sure, so this is not true. And the other one, which is more interesting, is the cases of António de Cristo and Francisco da Encarnação, who dared to challenge Shah Jahan when the emperor decided to forcefully convert some of the captives to Islam. As a consequence, the emperor decided to kill the two Augustinian priests because they were resisting and trying to avoid other people to be converted. And so they were supposed to be smashed by elephants, but miraculously the elephants took a step, they stepped back and started venerating the two priests. And I bring actually an image which is known to some of the people in the room, those who do Southeast Asia. This is a Portuguese manuscript of a lay martyrdom. It's not a religious martyrdom. Written by a guy called Manuel Godinho de Heredia. I'm not going to expand on that, but it's an example of what was going on, accordingly to the Augustinians, in Agra in 1632, 1633. So you see all these possible ways to deal with the problem. We have the Augustinians with a very harsh religious vision of the problem. And then you have some Jesuit sources, which actually, even being Jesuits and religious sources, contradict the Augustinians and go a bit in the direction of the kind of decisions and discussions that were being taken in Goa. For example, even before I give you two or three examples and then we stop, we can go through that during the Q&A period. But as this Jesuit Giuseppe de Castro, because he was Italian, in 1631, before Ugli, he says that the emperor is contrary to our holy faith, but he nevertheless allows the presence of missionaries in his domains, provided that they do not seek to convert Muslims. And the same thing says one Portuguese merchant, Manuel da Silva, who is an informer of the Portuguese viceroy from Gujarat. And he says the Portuguese, the Dutch, and the English were brought to the presence of the emperor. And he said, from now on, that's fine. The ones who are converted, they will remain Christians, but please do not convert more people. And he says, he said this with great passion. But anyway, there's no forced conversion. It's something that we see in other sources. It's something that the Augustinians were playing, but it's clear that which is not the case. And a final episode is the destruction of the Portuguese, of the Catholic Church in Agra in 1635. And there's a big discussion on this. And then there's a farman of Shah Jahan actually restoring the church and giving again to the Jesuits all their goods and all their assets. So again, this is kind of contradiction between destroying a church and then the restoration of the church in a very, very close period of time. And again, the Portuguese, the Jesuit reactions to this are very interesting. Some Jesuits say, you know, the ways in which the captives of Ugli behave in Agra, actually, it's clear that Shah Jahan had to react like that. They are unruly people. They cannot behave themselves. One of them, Antonio Botelho, Portuguese Jesuit, says they behave as if they were in their own house. And an interesting episode on in Easter time, the Christians made the statue of a Judah, hang Judas. And the Muslims thought that this was Muhammad. So they went on to the mullahs and the qazi, and Shah Jahan knew about this. And so this episode, the Jesuits say, present this episode as one of the things that the Portuguese Christians in Agra shouldn't do, which is play with images confront the Muslims in some way and giving the chance for them to strike back. And it's very interesting. The Jesuit writings about what was going on in Agra are much more tempered than the Augustinian chronicles and very much more in line with the kind of reasoning, political reasoning that in Goa was taking place. So I'll stop here. Thank you very much.